Welcome to The Legal Impact, presented by the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law. I'm your host, Laura Kanoy. Today, a review of the major cases against former President Donald Trump. The courts could make some key decisions in the coming months, so it's a good time to recall what the main legal arguments are against the former president, where these cases stand, and of course, what's at stake. But before we begin, an important reminder that we are recording on March 28th about a topic that is quite fluid and sometimes seems to change daily. Still, we can talk about the legal principles that are under review and what the legal impact might be once these cases are decided. It is complicated for sure, which is why I really appreciate the help of our guest today, UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law Assistant Professor Daniel Pye. His research applies economic theory to legal questions across diverse subject areas, including criminal law and constitutional law. And Professor Pye, a big welcome to The Legal Impact.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Politico magazine said this about just the sheer volume of legal actions against the former president. Politico said, "Today, merely keeping track of the many cases against Donald Trump requires a law degree, a great deal of attention, or both." I thought that was a great quote, Professor Pye, and I wonder how you keep track of these cases in your own mind. How do you keep them organized? How do you keep them sorted?
Yeah, it's tough to keep track of these things. It's helpful that they're often in the news, and it's you can't help but notice them when you're watching CNN or MSNBC, and they report on these things. Really, you can narrow it down a little bit. There's the criminal cases and the civil cases, and then within that, there's the federal cases criminally, and there's the Georgia case criminally. And that kind of helps to keep track of what's going on. Of course, there are lots of little cases going on as well. There's also the hush money payments case, and that's probably less consequential, but yeah, it's challenging. I guess the short answer is it's very challenging, and I often lose track too.
Okay, that makes me feel a little bit better, Professor Pye. I wonder what your students are saying about these. What sorts of questions do they have?
Well, they're very interested in this, not just as law students, but also as citizens. And it's interesting teaching constitutional law during this time. So oftentimes, the way that we divide constitutional law issues, it's between rights, so like the right to abortion, the right to free speech, and powers. So what is the power of the federal government? What's the power of the executive or the legislature? The powers stuff, which is usually in the course Constitutional Law 1, is pretty stable. That doesn't change a lot. There were some changes during the FDR period where he was expanding the scope of the federal government and creating these agencies to fight the Depression. But in general, the powers stuff is pretty well settled. There was a bit of activity during the Nixon years for reasons you might imagine, but it's been fairly quiet until now. And there's this huge slew of cases, and I feel a little bit sorry for the students, because a lot of what we're learning may no longer be good law by the time they graduate. So there's a lot of action happening in that area. And so it's interesting, and it's fun to try to weave them into the cases that we're reading as the normal part of our curriculum.
Right. Well, at least you have sort of real life examples to discuss with them. You know, talking about rights, I wonder, Professor Pye, how much does the fact that these cases involve a former president, you know, change his status or his rights as a defendant? I mean, does Donald Trump have certain rights and responsibilities because of that status?
Well, he's claiming that he has absolute immunity for things that he did when he was president. And so he's saying that the criminal charges against him have to be dismissed because he can't be criminally liable because he was the president. And this is not a totally absurd claim. The president does have immunities. And for instance, the president is immune from civil lawsuits. And there's a good reason for that, because you can imagine that anybody who was harmed in any way by the decisions of a president during their tenure could then go back and sue the president and say, well, I want damages for this effect that you caused. And so generally speaking, that is the law. But whether or not a president should be immune from criminal liability is a novel question. It's something that's being tested now. And it's not implausible. It's not crazy to say that presidents ought to be immune to some extent from criminal liability. For example, if they order some military action and it later turns out it wasn't so well justified, you wouldn't want a president then to be on the hook for murder. The issue here is whether he has absolute immunity, because it's not like what he was doing was making a bad call on a military action or something like that. It seems like what he was trying to do was to undermine core principles of democracy and the functioning of the government. And so when he claims absolute immunity, it goes rather further. And that claim was heard by the DC Circuit Court, and they said that he did not have absolute immunity, that there were limits to presidential immunity from criminal liability. Trump has appealed that, and that is set to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. That was a little bit of a surprise because the opinion from the D.C. Circuit was very well articulated and convincing. There are a number of reasons why the U.S. Supreme Court might want to hear the case. I mean, they may want to grant him absolute immunity. That seems to me unlikely, but that's possible. Or they could want to just ratify the decision, because as it stands, other circuit courts, other parts of the country aren't bound by what the DC circuit says. So if the US Supreme Court says that they agree with the DC circuit, then now the whole country is bound by that. And so Trump could not claim absolute immunity in a different circuit, say, right? Yeah, so there is clearly a benefit to doing that from the perspective of establishing uniform law across the country. But it's not like this comes up very often. This is the first time a president has asserted absolute immunity from criminal prosecution. And so it's not like the country was sorely in need of a final resolution to bind all the circuits, you know, with a Supreme Court decision. So some people have speculated that they're going to just do him a little favor and by delaying the process, because they can't have a trial until they get resolution on the question of whether he's absolutely immune. And so that delays things. And
the DC circuit. Yeah, go ahead.
The election interference trial is happening in the DC circuit, and that trial is kind of on pause until they can get a determination of whether or not he's immune. If he's immune, obviously there's no point in having a trial. So they're pausing the fact-finding and the trial court proceedings until they can get an answer on the legal question of whether he is absolutely immune. And even if they decide that he's not, by hearing the case in April, that delays things even further. In Trump's case, time is on, you know, the longer he waits, the better for him, because if he can limp his way to January without getting convicted, then he can, of course, just pardon himself.
Well, and this relates to something else that's kind of overhanging a lot of these cases, right, Professor Pai? And that's the timing issue. So, as you said, the D.C. Circuit Court's case is on hold while the U.S. Supreme Court decides whether the president has immunity in absolute immunity for criminal cases. I think the Supreme Court's going to hear on April 25th, but my understanding is, Professor Pai, the Supreme Court doesn't issue its rulings until June, right? So now we're in June. So, right? I mean, then what?
Well, it's possible that they will just announce the decision with the other cases that they're hearing this term. But given the importance and urgency of determining this result, they can and have issued decisions on a faster timeline. So it's not necessarily the case that we're going to have to wait till June for them to make a decision on this.
Okay, well, let's take the case from Georgia next, concerning, again, election interference. Just briefly remind us, Professor Pai, please, of the charges brought in this case by the Fulton County District Attorney.
Sure. Okay, so the Georgia case is different. The Georgia case is, it's not federal, and so the immunity claim doesn't affect that. So they are charging him with under racketeering and also interference with, well, solicitation for a violation of oath from Brad Raffensperger, false statements, impersonating public officer, that's the fake electors, forgery, filing false documents, a bunch of those things. So currently where that stands is that there's no trial date that's set yet. They have contemplated an August trial. Recently in the news, six of the charges, so there's a lot of charges that the prosecutor is charging him with. Six of those have been dismissed, and the reason is that the prosecution did not sufficiently state what the crime was. So, I mean, you can say what the offense was, the point to the statute, but like specifically what facts would satisfy that. The judge said it was you know, too vague and ambiguous what they were talking about. And so under Georgia law, they can't amend their criminal complaint. And so those are just off. That doesn't mean that he's not guilty. That doesn't mean they can't bring it again. But it does mean that they would have to indict him again with those charges. They'd have to bring it before a grand jury to get those charges put back on. And so I think those charges related to the solicitation of violation of oath. So that's where that stands right now.
It had to do with the former president allegedly trying to find votes, right? Trying to find extra votes in Georgia.
Right. So, there's four things that were going on there. So he attempted to pressure the Georgia Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger. And then he also attempted to recruit and legitimize fake electors. And there was also it's not reported as much, but there was people associated with Trump lied to gain access to voting equipment and then took data from that equipment, which is also a crime. And then there was subsequently harassment of Fulton County election workers. And so all of those things, those four things, have led to the bevy of charges against him.
Okay. And just remind us, Professor Pai, and it's so much work to wade through it, and I really appreciate it. So where does the Georgia case stand now?
Well, right now, there is no trial date that's set. So what they're looking at is August. They want to get this done sooner. But even if they started in August, this is complicated. There are a lot of charges. There's no reason to believe that it would necessarily be finished by the end of the year or by the time he became president if he won the election. But he would not be able to pardon himself from conviction by the Georgia courts because the president only has the power to pardon people who are convicted of federal crimes or who might be convicted of federal crimes. So he wouldn't have the power to pardon himself if he were convicted in that case.
Oh, that's an interesting point, Professor Pai. Thank you for the clarification. So that's what makes this Georgia case so distinctive is even if the U.S. Supreme Court granted Donald Trump, you know, full immunity, that's because it's a federal case. He's not immune from prosecution and possible conviction in this Georgia case.
So I was talking about whether he could pardon himself. He definitely cannot pardon himself. If he's immune, the extent of that immunity is, I mean, it is unclear what the Supreme Court would say. You would think that if he should be immune as in virtue of his office as president, if he should be immune from criminal prosecutions, then you would think that that would also include state prosecutions as well, because what's the point of saying that he's immune from federal prosecutions, but he could still be sued in any state? And so logically, that would apply to tort claims, civil claims. And so you would think that that would also be the case with criminal claims. If the policy point that underlies immunity is that presidents should be able to make big decisions and not have to fear personal consequences of those decisions after they leave office, then you would think that that would apply also to the states. And so the presidential immunity claim may be something that would stop the Georgia case as well, but he wouldn't be able to pardon himself. So the point is that there's not a timeline on that.
So there's one more case we should talk about, Professor Pai, and that is the classified documents case. And this concerns the former president taking classified documents to his Florida mansion. And then the case says, haphazardly storing them with little regard for the sensitive nature of the information. Trump is also accused of blocking federal attempts to get the documents back. A trial is scheduled in Florida. We've gone from Georgia to Florida for late May. But I've read, Professor Pai, that the judge is, quote, widely expected to postpone it. So what would be the impact of that postponement?
Well, again, it's happening in Florida, but it's not a Florida case. This is also a federal case. And the judge is a Trump appointee, Eileen Cannon, who has previously shown, well, let's say, bias towards Trump, I mean, in favor of Trump. And she understands that she's under a microscope. She's been rebuked by the appeals court. And so it is questionable whether or not she would try anything that was really improper, but it is part of managing a trial that the judge can decide to postpone things. The prosecutor, Jack Smith, has proposed starting the trial in July, but at the present moment, there isn't a trial date set for that. That is the most, in a way, it is the most significant case to watch because it is a kind of a slam dunk. There's an enormous amount of evidence. The complaint was very well argued. It doesn't seem like there's anything. There's no gaps. There isn't a plausible, other than claiming presidential immunity, which would also cover this case. There isn't anything that any plausible defense that Trump could have. It's just complicated because it involves a lot of evidence. But this is something where Trump is almost, well, very likely to be found guilty.
Well, and since you mentioned the politics of this, how concerned are you that once some of these cases eventually are decided, Americans will react cynically? You know, that if their side loses, it'll just solidify a feeling that the court system has become just another political body.
Yeah, I mean, that is that is the risk. And I think where we are as a country right now, things are so polarized that whatever happens, the people who support Trump will say, if he wins, they'll say, well, that's justice. Right? And if he loses, they're going to say, well, the system is rigged. And vice versa, right? Maybe people who oppose Trump are going to say that the system is rigged or that things were unfair or there was a technicality if Trump wins. And otherwise, they're going to say, well, then there was justice. What can we do? I mean, it's not like we can't try these cases. I mean, there are actual disputes. The allegations are serious. There is a colorable argument. The evidence seems strong, especially in the documents case, but in all of the cases, these are not frivolous. And so they have to go forward with it. I think that the public perceptions element of it played it was a very important factor in the Colorado versus Anderson case. Now, that has been resolved, but that was very interesting. You'll recall the facts in that case were that the Colorado decided that because of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, that Trump had violated his oath in trying to foment an insurrection against the government, that he was no longer eligible to be president. And therefore, they disqualified him from the ballot, and they tried to prevent Trump from even being on the Colorado ballot. And then there was a question of whether that was constitutional or not. And that went to the Supreme Court and got a decision. And while they don't reach the merits of whether or not Trump actually fomented an insurrection or a rebellion, rather, they just said that Colorado does not have the authority to do that. And in that case, I think there was a lot of contemplation of whether or not this is the right way for Trump not to win, right? Because in a way, if you remove Trump from the ballot, then you're playing into the narrative that he's telling his followers, right? He's saying that the system is rigged. And to the people who support Trump, they see that, well, they didn't beat him in an election, so they just removed him from the ballot. In a way, you're confirming their suspicions about the government. And so I think a lot of care needs to be taken in how this is being treated. But with criminal cases, ultimately, it is a question of whether or not the elements in the offense are satisfied by the facts that are brought to evidence by the prosecution. And this is a very mechanical thing. So hopefully politics doesn't play too much of a role there, but there needs to be a decision, and the decision is supposed to be something that happens, that sort of falls out mechanistically from an application of the rule to the facts of the case.
So these will be seen politically, but we have to have these decisions. We have to go through this process, even if people are going to react cynically.
Yeah, it's inevitable. We live in cynical times. So it's inevitable that people are going to view this through a political lens. I mean, in the case of the Colorado ballot case, that I think plausibly lends itself more to political interpretations, but the criminal stuff is just criminal. So there's a statute that has elements, and they're either satisfied or they're not.
Well, Professor Pai, we have run out of time, and we could have talked a lot longer. I really appreciate you being with us today and taking time out.
Sure. Happy to be here.
That's UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law Assistant Professor Daniel Pai. His research applies economic theory to legal questions across diverse subject areas, including criminal law and constitutional law. Well, that's it for this month's episode of The Legal Impact. I'm Laura Kanoy, Director of Community Engagement at Law School's Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service. Our show is recorded, edited, and produced by the Marlon Fitzwater Center for Communication at Franklin Pierce University, and a big thanks to the team there for making this program possible. Opinions discussed on The Legal Impact do not constitute legal advice or represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. Thanks, everyone, for listening to The Legal Impact.